You're listening to a production of the Center for Emerging Media. We hope you'll consider making a donation to us to help us continue to bring you these podcasts. Just go to our website and click on Donate. Thank you. I'm Mark Steiner, and we are sitting in the Department of Juvenile Services executive offices with Secretary Donald DeVore and some of his staff, and taping an interview for all of you. And Donald, good to see you again.
It's great to see you, Mark, and I'm so glad that you have found a niche.
Thank you. We're raring to go and enjoying where we are, and it's really great to have this time with you. And we've been talking to people all week, obviously, about juvenile services, and we talked, I think, I don't know, last year, not mm-hmm. long after you, twice at least, the first time long mm-hmm. after you took office. And you've been in office now, I guess, 14 months?
That's exactly correct.
Right. So it's interesting, but people in the community who care about juvenile justice, the advocates, parents, juvenile justice workers, some of the people who left your office as we were walking in, think a lot of you. And I think I said in my blog last week, there are a lot of issues, but for the first time maybe in the time I've been on the air, there's someone in office who seems to want to really make a difference.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. And I've particularly appreciated, as I mentioned before, the way that people in Maryland have welcomed me. Despite the history of the agency not having been responsive to the needs of children and family, people seem to realize that this is a very different time. And as the advocates were leaving here this morning, as you were coming in, we have a great dialogue about the challenges that confront us. And as a leader, I've attempted to be very open and honest to a fault about what those challenges are and the need for the community to embrace those challenges and assist me, much in the same way that Dr. Alonzo has been doing with the city schools.
Well, when you first came in, I mean, you opened yourself up actually to a lot of expectation because how you came in and things you said as you came in about the kinds of institutions you thought we needed in the state of Maryland to make juvenile services work. Let's start off with the latest that the controversies have been surrounding the downtown juvenile justice center, mm-hmm. the detention center downtown. I remember when it was built, Bishop Robinson, who was the then Secretary of Department of Juvenile Services before that, Head of Corrections, and before that, Police Commissioner mm-hmm. in Baltimore City, refused to attend the consecration of the building.
He was probably right.
And he said, because we don't need this building, and we don't need any more large institutions, and that it's going to fail, he said. And this is coming from a guy who was a pretty well-known tough cop in his day. And now, the institution itself, from everybody I've talked to, and it's amazing, Donald, that everybody I've talked to, no one will speak to me on the record. Mm-hmm. No one. Mm-hmm. I think we must have talked to 15 people who talked to maybe 10 people each on their own, and none of those people will talk on the record.
Mm-hmm.
But they're all saying the inmates are running the institution,
mm-hmm.
and that people are terrified to work there, whether they're guards, whether they're therapists, whether they're teachers, and that parents of young people say their kids are terrified being inside there.
Mm-hmm.
And the inmates have taken over. So let's just start there, this kind okay, of yeah. most large statement.
Good place to start. I have, since I've been here, as you have indicated, have had some enormous challenges, none of them greater than the Justice Center. I'm really pleased that within the 1 year of being here, we've established some very specific goals for the agency. We have achieved some of those. For example, as you know, the legislature did support the advancement of the Maryland model through $200 million in capital funds. The Maryland model of small facilities, Bishop was right, small facilities located in the homes and in close proximity to the homes where these children are, with strong treatment and aftercare services. In the case of Baltimore City Juvenile Justice Center, we've had some gains there, but we continue to have some challenges. Let me talk about both of them.
Okay.
The gains I believe that we have is I believe that we have good leadership that's in place there, and leadership that is, in fact, responsive to both the needs of the children and the needs of the staff as well. One of the greatest challenges has been the crowding of the facility. When I first came here, walked through that facility, and I consider it to be quite a nightmarish building, the way it was designed.
Mm-hmm.
I had a friend of mine come in, a noted architect, to take a look at the facility, Roger Lichtman from Princeton, New Jersey, who in a report that he issued to us told us that minimally, to meet minimal industry standards, we would need another 50,000 square feet in that building. My training has generally been as a social psychologist, and in that I believe that what you need to know in order to predict behavior is a lot about the environment. I think when you take 144 explosive kids, some of whom have had long histories of arrest, you've seen Anna Lardo and other people that have written editorials about the numbers of arrests that many of these kids have had, and you put them in such a tight space that some of the behavior is predictable. That's not in any way to defend what's been going on. We're committed to changing it. But the physical facility has been an enormous challenge. The other thing that was a challenge for us was the fact that when we first came here, there was reasonably little constructively for the kids to do within that facility. In this last year, we've advanced the secretary's, meaning my, violence reduction campaign. And that has involved members of my executive staff, including myself, mentoring kids at the Justice Center. We have, of the 140 kids that are at the Justice Center today, we probably have about 40 of them that are waiting to go to placements. When I first arrived here, it was commonplace to have kids waiting to go to placements for upwards of a year. We've now cut that time down to about 60 days. It's unusual for youth to stay more than 60 days for that, which has made a great impact. When kids are at the Justice Center and they've lost hope and they feel that no one's really responding to them and they're sitting sort of in purgatory and waiting to go someplace and they're not quite sure exactly where that place is that they're going to go, and these are normally impulsive kids, many of them with mental health problems, it's an explosive mix. So some of the challenges, some of the wins that we've had, we have an excellent mental health provider that's now in the Justice Center, Hope Mental Health, where we're providing full mental health services to the kids. We've increased the programming there. We're working, as you know, with the Department of Education. We had a consent judgment that was entered into before I came here. It started in 2002, was signed in 2005. And the department is anticipating, in the case of both Hickey and Cheltenham, which have made massive turnarounds in the last year since I've been here, to exit out of that consent judgment. We've been in full compliance with all provisions of that. We also signed a consent judgment for the Justice Center. And we're doing reasonably well despite the challenges there, except for two areas, which I really, maybe we can talk about, which is protection from harm and the area of education.
So it's interesting that the as you describe what's going on downtown at the detention center, there are people that we've been talking to, again, unfortunately, who don't want to be identified.
Sure, I can understand
because of
that.
The work they do inside the juvenile justice world. They're saying, first of all, that the center is designed to hold 144 people, but it can't really hold that many safely.
I agree.
That it's, even at that number, it's overcrowded.
I agree. That speaks to Roger's comment about needing an additional 50,000 square feet to hit minimum standards. Just to give one example, there's six classrooms, there's 144 kids. You don't have to be an architect to know that to educate children, you need more than six classrooms where you're going to hold 12 students to a classroom. So it's forced us to educate kids in shifts. The dining facilities, we don't have enough mental health or medical facilities. So one of the things that we have been really pushing since I've been here through the Annie Casey Foundation has been the full adoption of the Juvenile Detention Alternative Initiative through Casey. And I brought a woman on board that I recruited from Washington State, Tina Borner. And there's been a huge focus, and that was the purpose of the meeting that I had earlier this morning, on making sure that we're using appropriate classification tools to determine which are the kids that can be released out into the community under some type of alternative program, and which are the kids that need to remain. That continues to be, I think, a highlight for us in the progress that we've made over the last year. For example, in Baltimore City, when I first arrived here, despite about 7 years of being involved with Annie Casey, Bart Lubow and others will tell you that they made simply no progress at all towards adopting the principles related to the juvenile detention. We have adopted our risk assessment instrument. We have automated that. And we've developed a system to closely monitor our alternatives, to notify judges where those availabilities are, to work with our facility providers and the judges to try to get kids that don't need to be there released from the facility. That definitely is something that we want to continue to work with both the Baltimore City Police Department. We also, in this last year, one of the governor's major initiatives has been the creation of a violence prevention unit through both on the adult side and on the juvenile side through the use of risk assessment instruments. We've identified in Baltimore City the 280 youth that we think are the highest on that risk scale. And have developed a specialized unit in work with the city through the Operation Safe Kids and through our violence prevention unit to wrap services around those kids and have them more closely monitored. This year right now, when we look at things statewide, our two of the goals that the governor has established and that we're working towards is to reduce the number of kids that die as a result of homicide and the number of kids that are engaged in shootings. This year, statewide, we're down about 32% where we were. Yesterday, I went to a funeral, Mark, of one of the kids that was killed last Saturday. His name's...
Yep, I heard about him.
And, whenever you go to these kinds of things, it's always difficult. Was a kid that I knew really well. When I first came here, he was down in our Carter Center down in Chestertown, and he was raising hell down there, and I couldn't believe that one kid could be creating the amount of disruption that he was down there, so I wanted to get down and meet him. And I went down there and met and we moved into one of our other facilities and gradually started to make some adjustments. September 9th of last year, he was committed to Karma, a group home, and 3 days later he absconded. And since September 12th of last year, Baltimore City Police, had been looking for him. And then, of course, we were notified that he was shot 4 times in an alley alongside his house. We simply, through the violence prevention unit and our work with our city partners in OSK, for kids like we need to find better ways to wrap services around them and protect them from some of the things that are happening on the street.
You raise a lot of things I just want to jump into here.
Sure.
If I might, one by one. And I want to do come back to kids like and talk a bit about.
Mm-hmm.
Not specifically, but I know something about his case as well. I know mm-hmm. people in the street who knew him. And I was not at the funeral, but because I wasn't in town, but I was notified of the funeral and I almost went myself.
Mm-hmm.
But let me go back to something you said earlier and then we'll come back to this, where we are with kids like you came in, as I said, Casey really wanted you here. A lot of advocates wanted you here. People still do believe in mm-hmm. what you're doing, but I think a lot of people I've spoken to are saying they don't understand why certain things haven't changed mm-hmm. and what's taking so long. I know it's only been 14 months and you're turning a battleship around, but let me lay some things out one by
sure,
one and
sure.
see if you can respond to them. One is that there are a lot of people involved, workers and former workers, who think that the assessment end, the front end of the institution, is in bad shape.
Mm-hmm.
That we're not assessing the most violent kids, understanding who they are, to separate them out, or assessing the ones that aren't that violent to be put somewhere else. That unit itself is in need of reform, desperately. And that the problem is that even if they are assessed, and I'll stop at this example so you have a chance to respond to this, if they are assessed, that for some reason, the local facilities, the local nonprofit community working with juvenile offenders, potentially work with them, have not been utilized. That when Ehrlich was governor, Robert Ehrlich was governor, there were 90 kids in placement outside the state of Maryland. I understand now it's like closer to 350 or 300.
No, that's not
okay,
that's
we can explain
true.
That, but that's what I've been told by a number of people. So you can, you can talk about that. But that we are not, that a ton of money is being put into back into Victor Cullen and back into places in Western Maryland, but none of the regional facilities, the small facilities that can take these kids and work with them, are being funded or utilized in this region. And that, well, let's just stop there. I mean, because this we're talking about there, the entry problem, that it's...
So you're talking about an area, you're sort of like talking my language, an area that I like to work in, I'm very familiar with. So let's talk about each of those, first of all. As far as the assessment is concerned, as I mentioned, we now have for the first time in Baltimore City and ever in history, we do have a risk assessment instrument that's been put in place that it's utilized for every single kid that comes to the Justice Center. Which I'd be glad to provide you with a copy of, that gives them a scale. The risk assessment instrument is one that's something that's been verified through research purposes through Annie Casey. It's similar. We've used a similar type of risk assessment instrument in a number of other counties, including Baltimore County and others that have adopted it since I've been here, too. Number two is, so how do you link those kids to those services that you're talking about? When I first came, it was very common. I'll just pick a particular place, ANCC's shelter, which is about a half a mile from the Justice Center. I went there and made a visit. Generally, they were occupied at about 40% of the utilization. We now, as a result of having done some of the things that I've mentioned, including keeping our staff and judges informed of occupancy rates, we've been running close to 90% of occupancy of the alternatives that are available to those kids. That's not true. As far as the out-of-state kids are concerned, that's something that we monitor extraordinarily closely since I've been here. I believe there's about 130 kids from juvenile service. I can get the exact number that are out-of-state. It may even be lower than that. I'm using a higher number. I think it's actually 103 to be exact. But that number has gone down since I've been here. I know at one time in the state it was as high as 700 or 800 kids that were out of state. That number has gone down considerably. One of the things that I've really prided myself on, and it's going to take time to root, Mark, there's no question about it, has been the advancement of evidence-based models in the state. We now have...
What does that mean?
Well, that means there are three particular practices that have been demonstrated to be very successful with high-risk populations. It's functional family therapy, multisystemic therapy, and multidimensional treatment foster care. I would refer everyone to a book that's well known by Peter Greenwood on changing lives, where there's extensive research that's been done on the effectiveness of these in-home service models for kids. Very effective and very cost-effective. I'll give you one really fast example. We have these in Baltimore City, but in the case of Baltimore County, we've been entering into counties with compacts. One of my goals is to treat Maryland's children in Maryland. One of the ways to do that is to reduce the unnecessary placement of kids in group homes. So in Baltimore County, through the county executive there, Jim Smith, we've entered into a compact using funds from the Hathaway Furbies Group, a Safe and Sound Foundation. They provided us with $400,000 in startup funds. We set out a process where kids that were identified for out-of-home placements would be referred to these evidence-based services. In this case, it's multisystemic therapy. The cost of sending a kid to a group home can be $100,000 a year. Many of the kids don't need to go there. We've had a lot of reductions and referrals there. The cost of providing multisystemic therapy is about $10,000. We agreed through this compact to return half of the savings back to the county for greater investment in services. So in this case, the difference is $90,000 or $45,000 going back to the county. This year, Baltimore County could see anywhere from $500,000 to $1 million coming back to them for reinvestment under a business model for more services. We're doing the same thing here in the city with FFT and MST to be able to further reduce. I think that I've had really good dialogue with advocates in the state. I've had a lot of support for them. We've been producing through our quality assurance department outcome data on all the things that we're doing and whether or not they're working and how they're working. I think that where you might find differences and speak to this very directly is that, you know, I inherited some institutions. You take Cheltenham, for example, that was constructed in the 1800s.
Right.
I felt, and I still feel, that it needs to be replaced. Because no matter how much we expand our community services, we're going to continue to have a need for a core group of kids down in that Prince George's County, to use Cheltenham as an example, that are going to need to be held in secure detention. And I think they should be held in modernized facilities that are smaller and more secure. This past year, as part of the advancement of that in Maryland model, not only do we expand our community services and the ones that I'm mentioning, but I also advocated very hard, and the governor did as well, for that $200 million to build some of these five new facilities. Mm-hmm. Some of the advocates will say, and I know they'll say it to you because they've said it to me because I'm out to lunch with them and talking with them, wow, for $188 million, just think about what we could do. What a waste of money to be spending on those facilities. Well, I respond to it by saying that no matter how idealistic you are, and I've been doing this now for 32 years, there's going to be a core group of kids that are going to require detention services. Fortunately, we're building smaller facilities than we have now and fewer beds. Let me just give you a really fast example. Cheltenham, we have about 119 kids there today. We're building a 48-bed detention center there. And we're building a 48-bed treatment center there. We're actually building, when you think that these facilities that we're building have sort of like a shelf life of 30 to 40 years, we are building smaller than what we already have. And why are we doing that? We're doing that because I sincerely believe that by working with things like evidence-based models, and our community providers that can demonstrate effectiveness in working with our kids through our local management boards, that we can drive down the numbers of kids that require that level of expensive care. But public safety dictates that there is going to be, here in Baltimore City, in Prince George's, Baltimore County, or Garrett County, there's going to be a certain percentage of kids who commit such serious and horrific crimes that they need to be held for a period of time to evaluate them, take a look at them, and understand what their needs are and how we can respond to those.
So the question, though, is if I think over the last 15 years of covering this issue, and
yeah, I know you've expressed your frustrations over this many times. You yourself were a case manager at one time.
I worked in the juvenile justice in the early 70s.
Yep.
In community programs, when there was, in pretrial programs for the most part. And in talking to a bunch of several advocates this morning, they were, on the one hand, all singing your praises as somebody who really wants to change the system, but saying exactly what you said about the $200 million extra you got in a year.
I know that.
$1.8 million
They tell me the same thing. So, and I defend it the same way I just defended it to you.
So the question I have, though, is, and I mean, let me coin a phrase that's not used yet, but it may become a phrase we'll start coining, and that is, maybe you have to Alonzo it, in a sense. I keep thinking of what, and I had a long talk with him about this the other week, and we're going to see him again this week about how he cut hundreds of millions of dollars from the North Avenue staff to put it back in the schools.
Mm-hmm.
And when I talked to one advocate this morning, I said, what do you think it would take? And he said, well, I think you have to take money away from your bureaucracy inside the Department of Juvenile Services, mm-hmm. put it in community facilities instead, and restructure it in such a radical way that it makes a radical change. Mm-hmm. And if you don't do that, you don't change the assessment institution. Mm-hmm. And someone also said to me, the other thing is, you have to, in a very large way, stop being afraid, which I think I wrote on my blog earlier in the week, to bring in ex-offenders to be a critical component, mm-hmm. a large critical component, in working in the facilities and working mm-hmm. with the kids. Mm-hmm. And have this relationship between teachers, counselors, therapists, and ex-offenders working with in small facilities. Mm-hmm. And unless you make a radical jump, well, all the stuff in the world's not going to change.
Yeah, I would just say that I think in the last year we have done some very radical things and are going to continue to. We've not expanded our administrative staff. Matter of fact, it's smaller. You know, Mark, when you and I had our last conversation, I came on board March the 1st. On January 22nd, Isaiah Simmons died at Bowling Brook during a three-hour restraint. Yep. And the system was in crisis.
Right.
And I had 11 institutions that I was operating that were all at different levels of crisis. I have one now that's experiencing a crisis,
You're
which is
the
Justice
Center.
Correct. But throughout the state, throughout the entire state, I had these facilities. And we've demonstrated our competence in terms of not only stabilizing and making those facilities. Our Victor Cullen facility, I believe, is going to become a national model for how to work with kids in small groups in a treatment setting. We now have at Victor Cullen, for the first time in the state, we have a pre-apprentice program for the kids that are there to actually work with the trade unions in the state to get real meaningful job skills, which is what kids want. They want to make money. When I was in Connecticut, one of the things that we did with the trade unions, we worked with the painters and the glazers. It was a really short apprentice period where kids could get in and earn $32, $35 an hour spray painting buildings and working on glazing and that kind of stuff. Our treatment model there, I think, is very good. We plan to replicate that in some of the other facilities. While I am extremely committed, as I said, to working with our community service providers, but at the same time requiring them to demonstrate evidence of their effectiveness in funding them and in expanding that. I'm committed to those things. I think that a lot of things that we have done have been very radical, have been very important to the state. The Baltimore City has several dimensions to it that we've been working on. First of all, you probably read that under my leadership, we have about 2,400 active cases in Baltimore City, right now. I committed to reviewing every one of those to have a good understanding of what the nature and level of service was to kids within Baltimore City. We did the first review of about 1,100 of those on a weekend where I actually recruited volunteers from across the state that were our best case managers to come into Baltimore City and to look at those practices and to be able to develop recommendations. During this week, we've been completing that review of those other 12 to 1,300 cases so that we can, in fact, develop a model of responsiveness to kids and families that we can be proud of. There's no question that in Baltimore City, it's needed that for probably over 30 years and did not have that kind of attention or leadership to the issue of case management. That's where it really happens. In the same way that it happens in the police department at the patrol level and the involvement with the kids and that initial decision that's made on whether to arrest a youth or not, it's in the same way in my Baltimore City case management office. Those folks have to be well-trained, competent, reasonable caseloads, to be able to be responsive to kids. We also have instituted within the last year, and we made a report to the governor on Tuesday night, the Maryland's first interagency strategic planning effort. When you and I talked the last time, I told you this was one of the things I hope to do. It's something that we've accomplished within the last year. It brings together DHMH, DHR, DJS, and MSDE around the table to develop the first...
Department of Environment, you're talking about?
MSDE, which did I say? DHR, Department of Human Resources.
Human Resources.
Human Resources, yeah. Brendan Donald's organization.
Right, right.
To come together and to develop the first interagency strategic plan for Maryland. A great majority of my kids that come into my system, as we've discussed before, are kids that at early age have experienced issues related to child maltreatment. Being able to identify those kids and respond to that at an earlier point and be able to bring our services together for those four state agencies rather than being siloed in the way they have historically, I also believe is going to result in some great changes for the state.
So quickly, because I know we're running out of time here, and I'll be able to cover a couple of things. That. So then if we go back for a second to the detention center here in Baltimore mm-hmm. City. So what is your timeline plan for making it a viable institution? How do you, what?
6 months.
Six, and what happens in 6 months?
We do have a plan right now that we're in the process of implementing, where we anticipate to see substantial changes within 6 months. I have to tell you that I don't share everyone's view that you may have talked to in terms of the institution mm-hmm. and how it operates. There are a lot of staff that are at the Justice Center because I myself are down there at least twice a week and sometimes more frequently. I was twice down there already this week, including last night, for a reform committee that I personally chair that takes place during the evening. We have a lot of staff down there, Mark, that are extraordinary staff that do some amazing work with the kids. When I went to a funeral yesterday, you know, and I went into an area that's, I think, not a particularly safe neighborhood.
Yep.
As soon as I got out of my car, I had a whole group of those staff that sort of wrapped themselves around me. And, you know, I felt very cared for and protected. I know that those people there at the facility, many of them care for me in the same way that I do for them. And they believe that we are on the right track to reform. The fact that the people didn't have the numbers of staff they needed, had no training at all, which we have put in place, and certainly didn't have support at my level for the reforms that we want to see there. I know they appreciate that because they say that to me every time that I'm down there. We will change this, but there's some things that need to happen, and maybe we could emphasize those, that need to happen over this next 6 months.
Finish what you're saying.
Okay, that's all right. I was going to say the first thing that needs to happen is a reduction in the population. And we need to do that in working with our community partners, working with the Baltimore City Police Department to make sure that we do that in a way that's appropriate and that provides for public safety while at the same time making sure that kids are served. I don't want to push kids out on the street just to reduce the population without seeing that they're not receiving services.
Well, and on that vein, another just an interesting different critiques I've had as we've interviewed people over the week thinking about coming to see you mm-hmm. was that even though you have these community advisory boards for different institutions that you've created, which is a good thing, mm-hmm. Every good thing has a critique, of course, in this world, especially when you are a secretary of an agency, that the neighborhoods where the most children come from that are getting in trouble are certain parts of East Baltimore, the West Side, and Park Heights.
Yeah.
So the question is, why are we not being proactive about going into those neighborhoods and hearing what the communities think they need as an assessment tool about what to do? Mm. And maybe those are the places mm-hmm. where if this group of the you're pulling together of cabin officers is really going to work,
yep.
Creates pre-trial counseling centers and even community correction centers that don't necessarily have to be overnight facilities, some may be, in those neighborhoods. They're
well,
saying, let's bring those people together and figure out what to do proactively.
Sure. First of all, let me just say, you know, just leaving our office as you were coming in was Dr. Washington.
Yes.
That she is the chairperson of our community advisory board for the Juvenile Justice Center. I would ask you to speak with her. That's an extraordinarily diverse group of people that come from the exact neighborhoods that you're talking about. And this includes people, many of whom themselves have experienced difficulties when they were kids. So we have them that are participating on those groups. They are people of color. They're diverse groups of people that represent all of the different neighborhoods throughout the city. And they have been contributing to this process of reform at the Juvenile Justice Center. That was part of the discussion that we just had before you came in.
I've been interesting, I think, for the citizens of the state to hear something. I'm going to throw a proposal. You don't even have to commit to it at this moment, but here's an idea. Supposing we had a, since we have this availability now at EAA, supposing we had a closed, and I mean closed, it's not, we're not going to put this out, I'm just going to throw this out to you, though, that a closed town meeting with you, the other secretaries, some of the advocates and community people, in a closed setting, in a, it's small enough to have a discussion about the future and your plans, that would not necessarily be a screaming, shouting match, because you'd have a a group of people in that room who all want the same thing. It could be an interesting dialogue for community.
Let me just say, we've been doing that throughout the last year. We've had, as part of our interagency strategic plan, we have sponsored throughout the state exactly what you're talking about, community forums. Our partners in that was Innovation Institutes from University of Maryland as part of the strategic plan. And the secretaries, including myself, have been going out throughout the entire state in organized community forums to listen directly to groups of kids, groups of parents, and groups of providers, and that breaking down in that order, to listen to them to provide feedback about what they think was important, what's effective, and what the needs are in the state. I've had my ears very, very wide open to people and their opinions during this last year. The only difference that we've experienced, and I'm trying to be very open about this, has been where to put the money first. I think we need to do it in things like compacts that encourage counties to accept greater responsibilities for the kids that are in their counties, through business models that provide incentives for treating kids right and getting the right kind of outcomes that we're looking for. But I also believe, you know, I've come into this state any number of times over the last 15 years as a consultant or someone with Department of Justice to go into facilities like Cheltenham and Hickey, and I've observed some really horrific conditions there. I was on a team that shut down Cheltenham on a Friday night with the Youth Law Center because the conditions there were so bad. Programmatically, we're doing excellent at those facilities, and I would welcome you to come at any time and make an unannounced inspection and visit to those facilities and talk with the kids in groups without me or any of my staff there, because we let everybody else do that too. So I would extend the same opportunity to you.
We'll take you up on it.
Okay, at any time you'd like to do. But what we don't have is we don't have the physical facilities to match up to some of the progressive programmatic things that we're doing for the kids. And we need those physical facilities. I really believe that that the department has a role, and the department's role is to deal with the kids that nobody else is willing to deal with or capable of dealing with. And those are the kids that are at the deep end of our system, kids like Kenneth. And for those kids, I want the facilities to, when a kid walks into the door, it's not good enough to tell them that you care about them and put them into a room that's 60 or 70 years old with the old, you know, Gothic type of hardware on it and, you know, asbestos tile floors that may still smell from urine. It's important that it be like our Western Maryland Children's Center, our Eastern Shore Children's Centers, that these be modernized facilities that are reflective of that care and concern that we have for them. And I'm very committed to replacing those facilities.
So finally, do you think then that the facility we have here in downtown Baltimore needs to be shut down, closed down, torn down, and started over so it looks like the place you say Victor Cullen and the other ones are?
Yeah, I believe that it needs dramatic architectural changes. So we have to go one of two directions, being honest. If we need to complete this assessment and really understand how many kids represent that level of risk based on our instrument, which I'll be happy to provide to you, that needs secure detention. If that's the number of kids that are presently there, which is about 138 today or so, then we need to do some massive expansion there. If that instrument demonstrates to us, that I'm hoping it will, that that's a much lesser number than that, maybe in the range of 80 or so, which is where I think it should be, then we still need to make some renovations, but that wouldn't require us to expand beyond the present core of the facility. We could simply close down some units and renovate them to provide additional recreation and educational classroom space for the kids. I promise you, we will get there very shortly, and we'll do it in a way of engagement with other people, not in a process of isolation.
Tom LaVore, thank you so much.
Okay.
Good to talk to you. We'll see you again soon, I hope.
I hope so.
You're listening to a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. And thanks to Clean Cuts Music and Sound Design for studio space. To hear more and learn more, visit us on the web at www.centerforemergingmedia.com. And for the Center for Emerging Media, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.